Welcome to Drive Time GP, your trusted source for the latest healthcare news, specially designed for Australia's GPs. Interviews are available both online and through a private podcast. Don't forget, you can also claim CPD points for listening. Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. Obesity care, a chronic disease requiring lifelong management.
Obesity is one of the most common important barriers to optimum health and well-being in Australia. There are just so many related health impacts. Plus, there are of course those harmful weight stigmas, and it really impacts the quality of life of people with obesity. For context, overweight and obesity was responsible for 8.4% of Australia's total disease burden in 2018, making it the second leading contributor to disease burden after tobacco use. And that amounts to an economic impact of over $40 billion in 2019 alone. Glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists, or GLP-1 receptor agonists, initially were indicated for type 2 diabetes, but they typically lead to significant weight reduction and have been approved for weight management in the last few years. But their use has raised concerns among some about their long-term safety and efficacy, problems with cost and reimbursement, plus where they fit in with public health efforts to manage the obesity epidemic. To sort through it all, today we're talking to Professor Gary Kilov, who Drive Time listeners know very well. He's a GP with a number of hats. He wears academic roles. He's also on the RACGP special interest committees for both diabetes and chronic disease, and he's got an interest in all of these. And we're going to be talking about the current landscape of medications for weight management, including a new generation of weight loss medicines. Gary, welcome back to Drive Time Medical.
Jenny, it's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about obesity. It's become one of Australia's really most important challenges and one of the most expensive national health conditions. What are some of the challenges that we face in general practice with just dealing with obesity?
I think the importance of this shouldn't be underestimated. Obesity may well be the greatest pandemic humankind has faced by virtue of its extensive reach both in space and time. Every country in the world has seen increase in obesity rates, and this has been going on for at least half a century with no sign of flattening of the curve anywhere in the world, as far as we know, let alone reversal of this trend. So the problem is real, it's present, and it's worsening. So why have we been so ineffective in managing this? It's complex, and there are many, many aspects that have contributed to this. So one of them has been lack of understanding, lack of knowledge, which has led to stigma and bias. We've had a very nihilistic approach, blaming the patient for simply making poor life choices. And so, well, it's your fault, you've got to fix it. And sadly, this is not only pervasive through the general community, but the medical community has a lot to answer for as well in maintaining and perpetuating this mythology. We are now at a stage where the science is overwhelmingly pointing to the fact that this is a very complex condition of dysregulation, not unlike other conditions of dysregulation that we all treat. Dysglycemia, diabetes, hypertension, dyslipidemia. These are all situations where certain parameters have moved outside the Goldilocks zone to a point where they are presenting health risks. And this is no difference with obesity. And I will keep coming back to the fact that we need to have the same approaches with obesity as we do for all these other conditions of dysregulation that we treat very effectively. So the idea that simply eating less and moving more will fix the problem has been debunked over and over again. Weight loss is much more than simply addressing the aesthetics. This is important. We all want to feel good and look good, but it goes way beyond that because excess body weight, excess adiposity and lipotoxicity is a gateway to many, many other conditions. In fact, over 200 recognized complications, serious complications like diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease. So addressing excess adiposity is about much more than losing weight. It's about regaining health. The waters are also muddied by celebrities or media beating this up and really, unfortunately, confusing the issues And it's important, I think, that doctors are able to bring back some perspective for our patients. So just to summarise, treatment of obesity starts with optimising lifestyle, but then upon that, you scaffold whatever other interventions you need.
So let's talk about some of the pharmacology options. Can you tell us a little bit about what we currently have available for treating patients with obesity in Australia? So we have the GLP-1 receptor agonist, but now there is this new class of agonist, the dual GLP-1 and glucose-dependent insulinotrophic polypeptide, or GIP, agonist. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's a bit of a mouthful. So just in summary, we have 6 approved medications for weight loss. So I'm going to focus on 3 of these 6 medications, and these are all incretin-based. So very briefly, I suspect your listeners would be very, very familiar with GLP-1s for the management of diabetes, work through multiple pathways. But with respect to weight loss, we'll be looking at increasing satiety, decreasing appetite, and as a result, reduction in energy intake, which leads then to a net energy deficit resulting in weight loss. With respect to diabetes, there's increased glucose-dependent insulin production and reduction in release of glucose from the liver. So the agents are liraglutide and semaglutide. These are the GLP-1s. So some may be more familiar with the trade name Saxenda and now Wegovy. And the newest agent, the dual agonist, is tirzepatide, brand name Mounjaro. So tirzepatide, having the GLP-1 receptor agonist, piggybacks on some of those same mechanisms that the GLP-1s do. But GIP adds an additional factor to this. There's this additive benefit by targeting multiple endogenous nutrient-stimulated hormone pathways that have been implicated in energy homeostasis. And this synergistic interaction between GLP-1 and GIP may explain the substantial degree of weight loss reduction in response to tirzepatide as compared with GLP-1 receptor agonists.
Can you give us an overview of the efficacy of both the GLP-1 receptor agonists and these new dual GLP-1 GIP receptor agonists? What can people expect in terms of their weight loss?
So let's have a look at what a clinician might expect. And I specifically mention clinician rather than patient because it's important that individuals understand that there is significant variability in responses. But if we look at liraglutide, so that's Saxenda, you're looking at about 5.7 to 8 kilograms weight loss. Semaglutide, so that's Wegovy, we're looking at somewhere between 9.7 and 15.3 kilograms, so very impressive. But tirzepatide, 16.1 to 23.6 kilograms. Now, some patients will lose less, some will lose more, and it's important to manage those expectations when having that conversation with patients. So if we want to look at what the evidence base tells us, how these compare, because these were not a head-to-head study, so it's important to remember that. But in a meta-analysis of 7 randomized controlled trials that included over 12,000 patients fulfilling the indication criteria for prescribing these agents, so that is a body mass index of greater than or equal to 30 kilograms per meter squared or greater than 27 with associated obesity-related comorbidities, the investigators looked at the effects of these 3 incretin-based medications. And all of them led to substantial weight reduction, but weekly tirzepatide 10 milligrams and 15 milligrams outperformed the others. So to what extent can we expect outcomes with tirzepatide? So if we look at a tirzepatide randomized controlled trial, so this was a phase 3 double-blind RCT with over 2,500 adults, again, fulfilling the indications, the criteria for weight loss medication. In the placebo arm, so remembering that placebo is optimized lifestyle, patients were able to achieve a weight loss of 2.4%. This was over a 72-week period. Now, this gives an indication, a reminder of how incredibly difficult it is to lose weight simply by moving more and eating less. This 2.4% equated to around 2.4 kilograms. The 5 milligram dose of tirzepatide, on the other hand, achieved an average weight loss of 16% of body weight, equating to about 16.1 kilograms. The 10 milligram, 21.4% or 22.2 kilograms, and the 15 milligram dose, 22.5% or 23.6 kilograms on average.
Gary, what about the comorbidities that we see with obesity? Do we see improvements in those as well with tirzepatide?
So the Surmount 1 study showed that tirzepatide treatment significantly reduced the 10-year predicted risk of new-onset type 2 diabetes compared with placebo. And you would expect that because this is a very effective diabetes medication. And we know that obesity drives diabetes. These are very closely linked. The nexus between diabetes and obesity is such that it has its own name, diabesity. Another example in the Surmount 4 study showed that compared with placebo, tirzepatide was associated with a number of improvements in cardiometabolic risk factors. So these are surrogate measures. These are not clinical outcomes, but a reduction in waist circumference, a reduction in HbA1c, fasting glucose, in insulin levels, lipid profiles improved, and both systolic and diastolic blood pressure came down. I mentioned that these are surrogate markers, not cardiovascular endpoints, but these studies are in train at the moment, and we will have cardiovascular outcome data when these studies are completed and published. Another study is the Surmount Obstructive Sleep Apnea study. So again, looking beyond simple weight measure efficacy of these agents, but looking at the impact of these downstream conditions, and tirzepatide improved sleep apnea among persons with moderate to severe sleep apnea, and it improved both subjective and objective measurements. What I mean by that is the AHI, the apnea hypopnea index improved, body weight improved, hypoxic burden decreased, high sensitive C-reactive protein went down, as did blood pressure. But importantly, patients reported improved sleep-related outcomes. So not only were the numbers better, but patients actually felt better. And this is ultimately what we want to achieve. We want to achieve improvements in quality and quantity of life.
Gary, given how effective these medicines are, not just for treating obesity, but also for these obesity-related conditions, there are still a lot of concerns around their use, how to manage them. Can you tell us about the concerns that still persist?
So obesity is a chronic condition, a chronic disease that needs to be treated with the same seriousness as we would treat something like type 2 diabetes or hypertension, something we would treat in perpetuity. And we know what happens if you withdraw these medications. If you stop somebody's diabetes medications, we know what happens to their glucose. Stop their blood pressure medications, we know what happens to their blood pressure, and so on. And not surprisingly, when we remove whatever intervention it is that achieved the weight reduction, the weight comes back again. And it's not difficult to convince patients of that because many of the patients have been through weight cycling many, many times themselves. And so getting the understanding that we cannot cure obesity, we can treat it effectively, but a treatment needs to be in perpetuity. So if the logic doesn't convince anyone, then certainly we have the evidence. So we have both Wegovy data and Mounjaro data in withdrawal trials. So for example, in the semaglutide 2.4 milligram intervention, within a year of discontinuing medication, two-thirds of the prior weight was regained. Similar things were found with tirzepatide. One of the concerns that has come to light is loss of lean body mass. And in a situation where that may be excessive, we may be causing harm. So I think we need to dissect this a little bit and tease it out because there is going to be lean mass loss irrespective of the way in which weight loss is achieved. So we've seen this with surgery, we've seen this with intensive lifestyle modification, and so on. Now, not all lean mass loss is pathological. If you are carrying significant excess weight, if you carry a 20 or 30 kilogram backpack all day long, you will develop big muscles because you will need that to carry that extra weight. Once you've lost that 20 to 30 kilograms, your body has no reason to maintain that same muscle volume. Maintaining those tissues is expensive, and the body is thrifty, and it'll maintain just the right amount of muscle tissue to meet the body's needs. Now, this is important to differentiate from pathological loss of lean mass, which is sarcopenia, which we often think about in our aging population, our sedentary population. So how would one mitigate sarcopenia or defend against it? This is where I think your team-based approach is mandatory. Using an exercise physiologist to give somebody an individualized program, a resistance training, strength training, a dietitian who can optimize the diet. And that's very important because there is a real risk of malnutrition if there's significant reduction in food intake. So making sure that the diet is not only adequate but sufficient in protein to help defend that muscle loss.
There is no one-size-fits-all solution when it comes to weight loss. And also procedural options work best when they're combined with diet and lifestyle changes. You said exactly that. But can you tell us which patients are most suitable for these kinds of medications? And how do you even initiate that conversation with a patient about a medication?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, what I'm going to do is ask any listeners to basically dig into their own experience. There is nothing different about choosing a weight loss medication to any other. It's about informed consent. It's about what these medications are expected to do, what potential adverse effects individuals might have, and how we mitigate them. We would also then talk about what dose ranging we may need. We may need to escalate. We may need to intensify treatment. So we want somebody who buys into the concept of maximizing their health benefit, and part of that is weight loss, but the focus is going to be on improving health. So the indications for all weight loss medications are the same. The other issues are, and I think this is an important one to discuss with patients, and up front, we need to talk about the very substantial cost of treatment, because the treatment is about long-term sustainability. And while somebody might be able to maintain that for a short while, given that this is a lifetime condition with no cure, we need to look at what interventions are going to be sustainable for the patient, because it does mean a significant financial investment. As an example, a 5 milligram maintenance dose of tirzepatide is around $395. Of semaglutide, 2.4 milligrams maintenance dose is about $460 per month. As mentioned before, if somebody is not willing to adopt a healthy lifestyle, and I would struggle to simply prescribe something and allow that to do all the heavy lifting. All of our studies, all of the outcomes are based on a combination of optimized lifestyle with the medications then on top of that. And I make that point to the patients that any expectations you may have based on these studies, if you want to replicate them or come anywhere close to them, you need to replicate what's been done in the studies. And finally, it can be difficult to get the message across that this is in perpetuity. This is forever. Some intervention needs to be maintained if you want to achieve the weight loss and maintain it.
Once we've chosen that patient that's going to best benefit from these medicines, what kind of counselling do you give your patients, you know, before they start on this journey?
So with the incretin-based therapies, the adverse effect profiles are actually remarkably similar. So these adverse effects are gastrointestinal for the most part. The very common ones, and again, GPs would be very familiar with this, nausea, and some patients may experience vomiting, change in bowel habits, so constipation. You can also get diarrhea. In order to mitigate these effects, we know that slow titration, starting at a low dose, an example would be if one initiated tirzepatide, we'd start with the lowest dose, 2.5 milligrams once a week. And if we wanted to up titrate, we could do that after 4 weeks, but it doesn't have to be after 4 weeks. It can be extended longer than that if tolerability is an issue. And we would escalate by 2.5 milligrams with each dose escalation. So one could go from 2.5 to 5 and essentially go up incrementally by 2.5 to the top dose of 15 if required. Tirzepatide is now available in a quick pen, so this is very similar to the quick pen that individuals have been using for insulin delivery. Each pen has 4 doses of the nominated strength. The other issue, of course, is that not everyone is going to be a responder. And there is no purpose in continuing a medication that is deemed to be ineffective. So how would we define a responder? This is going to be somebody who, following the appropriate uptitration, fails to lose more than 5% of their body weight within 3 months of treatment. So just as we would not discontinue an effective medication, we would not continue an ineffective one.
Gary, it's such an important conversation around obesity and about these new agents that so many of our patients are asking about. Thank you so much for talking us through it. Can you summarise the key messages for GPs listening to us?
Thank you. So this is a global pandemic, as mentioned. We know that 2/3 of Australian adults live with overweight or obesity. This is not something for specialists to deal with. This is something that all of us have to deal with, all hands on deck, and of course this starts with primary care. Because obesity, excess adiposity, lipotoxicity has the potential to decrease quality and quantity of life, increase complication rates, irrespective of which area of medicine you're in. The starting point, again, is optimizing lifestyle, so that's physical activity, healthy dietary patterns, and certainly you can use your team-based approach, exercise physiologists, dietitians, psychologists if necessary, and many others, depending on the individual profile. We now have very effective medications and more coming that now can address this lipotoxicity, this excess adiposity. The ones that we've spoken about, tirzepatide, semaglutide, and liraglutide, all lead to effective weight reduction, but tirzepatide has been shown to be the most effective of these, whilst having a comparable safety and tolerability profile. Remember that withdrawing these medications will almost invariably result in a return of the weight. And so our interventions need to be in perpetuity. Which medication you choose will depend very much on that conversation you have with your patient, depending on their preferences, their comorbidities, their tolerability, and of course, their cost.
Professor Gary Kilov, thank you so much for joining us once again on Drive Time GP.
It's my pleasure.
Please note the PBS information for Mounjaro, tirzepatide, is not listed on the PBS. Before prescribing, please review the full product information. The substantiating references and product information can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Eli Lilly and produced in January 2025. Everything Menopause Miniseries, Part 8, Navigating Midlife Weight Gain, the impact of menopause on health and how to manage it.
The midlife and menopausal transition period are a time associated with changes in body composition and in many women, quite a lot of weight gain. We often see a loss in lean muscle mass and also bone density, as well as an accumulation of visceral adipose tissue, and all of that is linked with excess morbidity and mortality. Many women report that they're gaining this weight despite making no changes to their diet or exercise. So why does the menopause transition see this weight gain and bodily changes, and what are the implications for midlife health and beyond? And most importantly, how do we GPs help our patients who want to achieve optimum health at this often really difficult time? With us to discuss midlife weight gain in women is someone who's basically menopause royalty. She's a personal hero of mine. Professor Susan Davis is an endocrinologist. She's also the director of Monash University Women's Health Research Program. Sue, welcome back to Drive Time GP.
Thank you for having me.
Sue, so many women experience weight gain around midlife. What sort of weight gain are we talking about, and does it happen to everyone?
Most people, particularly women, will experience weight gain at midlife, and it's a really slow creep. It's sort of like 0.5 to 1 kilo a year that creeps on. And I guess when you gain 0.5 kilo, you probably think, oh, this is not much, but it sort of creeps progressively through those middle years, so that by the time women get into their 60s, they've suddenly realised they've gained quite a lot of weight.
It's a really complex issue. Can you talk to us about what is going on? Why are these women gaining this weight?
So this has been extensively studied. And in fact, if you look at the longitudinal studies, Penn Aging Study, the SWAN Study, the weight gain is most correlated with age and not menopause. But what we do see specifically related to menopause is an increase in subcutaneous fat and an increase in abdominal fat and visceral fat. And of course, we know that is fat that is biologically adverse in terms of disease risk, cardiovascular disease risk. And this increase in abdominal fat can occur even if women don't absolutely gain weight. And this is due to the fall in estrogen that occurs at menopause. And not just the direct effects on fat, but a whole host of effects that estrogen loss has on women.
So what are the consequences of gaining this weight?
So central abdominal weight gain is associated with cardiovascular disease, increased risk of insulin resistance and diabetes, increased risk of dementia, and increased risk of cancers, breast cancer, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, and other cancers. So abdominal fat, we know, is bad. And we know this is not just because women are eating more. It's due to biological factors, environmental factors, and sociological factors as well.
So a lot of our patients are coming to us GPs to talk about their weight gain. What do you think that we should do in that consultation? Like, what should we be giving our patients in terms of advice?
Well, I think firstly reassuring them that they're not bad people, because there's a lot of guilt and shame with weight gain. And often women have tried really fad things, and reassuring them that a more pragmatic approach to weight management is better, that not to try immediate diets and rapid weight loss, because we know rapid weight loss is often followed by weight gain. And I think the most important thing is sort of discussing why this is occurring, explaining that when their estrogen drops, they will tend to accumulate abdominal fat, that when estrogen drops, it alters their body's ability to handle sugar. So we know that glucose disposal in muscle diminishes after menopause. And also, loss of estrogen actually affects our body's response to satiety. So animal studies show that when animals are deprived of estrogen, they tend to be less active and eat more. So I think if women understand what's going on, they're more able to then work with you as a doctor to address this.
Can we talk about protein and the role of protein in the diet, particularly when it comes to weight gain? If you're on TikTok or Instagram, you'll be hearing that you've got to have more protein. You basically got to turn yourself into a protein molecule in order to lose weight. It can be really difficult to get the right amount of protein into the diet. What do we need in terms of protein? Like, what is the actual science, and what are your tips to get more protein into the diet for women at this stage of life?
Well, women need protein for satiety. They need protein to maintain their muscle mass. They need protein to keep their body healthy. So I encourage women not to weigh and measure everything, but rather to make sure that with each meal they have some protein. And protein gives you more satiety than carbohydrate. So you're less likely to be hungry between meals and snack if they're eating protein. The other thing is, you know, women are avoiding full cream dairy. But in fact, full cream dairy is very, very healthy. And studies done in Scandinavia actually have shown that women who drink full cream milk or have full cream yogurt, for example, have lower cholesterol levels, and it's better for them than having all the synthesized dairy products that are available. So again, I encourage people, if you can't catch or kill it or grow it, don't eat it.
I love that advice. Can we talk about skeletal muscle mass? Because we know that women start to lose that as they transition through menopause. How important is it for us to maintain our skeletal muscle mass, both in terms of well-being, but also in terms of weight? And how much does protein in the diet play a role in maintaining that skeletal muscle mass?
Look, protein's important, and it's pretty hard in Australia to get a protein-free diet. But critically for skeletal muscle mass is physical activity. And we know, for example, that women who lose weight, particularly with the new regimens and drugs for weight loss, that women will lose muscle as well as losing fat. And there's dramatic loss in muscle with the new drugs that are being used. And people are looking at ways to counteract that, not just by protein in the diet, but by good, solid physical activity. And as women get older, women are doing less physical activity than perhaps they have done in their younger years. Major loss of muscle mass doesn't really start to occur until women are in their 60s. And that's when we see progressive increases in sarcopenia. But it all goes into a bundle. It's not just one issue. The health, the weight gain, the diet, the physical activity are all things that impact issues like cardiovascular function, bone health, muscle function, and disease risk as women progress to later in life. So rather than just focusing on weight, I really see healthy lifestyle at midlife being the opportunity to turn the ship around for the second half of your life. And not just focusing on one particular issue, but focusing on the whole health package.
It's such great advice. You did mention exercise. I did want to drill down on that. Do you think that there is a best exercise for midlife women around menopause? What's your advice?
So firstly, women have this belief that if they go to the gym twice a week, that's going to counteract the whole day sitting, working in a sedentary job, or that Pilates is heavy-duty exercise. Women need to do cardiometabolic exercise where they're actually working up a sweat, and that means, you know, at least 150 minutes a week of doing something where you actually burn calories. That's not just to burn the calories, but that's to get your VO2 max up, to get your cardiac function going, to get your circulation moving. We need the cardiometabolic exercise. Then women need the exercise that's going to keep their muscles and their bones strong. And what we know from work done from Robin Daly's group in Melbourne at Deakin and La Trobe is that you need multimodal exercise. So exercise that improves core strength, because it's core strength that stops you falling over and getting a fracture. You need exercise for balance, and you need exercise that is impact for your bones. So bone strength is from impact exercise, like hopping or jumping or skipping or jogging. So a leisurely walk is nice and good for a woman, but is not the exercise we want women to be doing to be healthy. So there's getting the heart rate up, the VO2 max up, the bone strengthening and the muscle strengthening and the core strengthening. So multiple modes of exercise is important.
So a lot of the women that I see day to day, they're really busy at work, they've got a lot on in their lives, and some of them have got really nasty menopause symptoms as well. You know, they might be having some vasomotor symptoms, they've got some joint pains, they might not be sleeping that well. And it feels like a really tall order to say, right, we're going to start today, we've got to really take this exercise very seriously, and we need multimodal exercise. What are your tips for us GPs to have that conversation with our patients to actually motivate them to do it? Because I see a lot of resistance and a lot of reasons why women can't at this stage.
So I think there are two issues here. One issue is if you've never been an exerciser, it's very hard to start at midlife. And two, at this stage of life, as we know, women have so many responsibilities and being pulled in so many different directions and feel obliged to be caring and nurturing other people. So one, convincing women it is okay to take time for themselves. That's the first thing. And get someone else to cook dinner or do the shopping, or, you know, it is okay to delegate household responsibilities, because if they fall over, the rest of the family is going to probably fall over. So that's the first thing. Take time for yourself. And for exercise, I really encourage women to find something they enjoy. It's hard doing exercise if you don't enjoy it. Try and find a social group that you can exercise with, an exercise club, or something where you can go and actually get more than the exercise out of it, but some social side. So you actually end up wanting to go for the social engagement as much as the exercise. And there are so many groups. There are park groups happening now. There are cycling groups. There are swimming groups. I know swimming's not the perfect exercise, but if you engage in one exercise, you're probably going to engage in others. So they're my tips.
I love that. And I remember at the International Menopause Society Congress, where Robin Daly, that you just mentioned, in his session, he was talking about snackable exercise. He was saying you could just do 10 minutes at a time if you're really busy and just get up from your desk and do 10 minutes at a time. I thought that was really great advice for a very busy person. You're probably not going to work up a sweat in 10 minutes. One of the things that I hear as well, Sue, is lots of my patients are quite nervous about menopause hormone therapy because they say it's going to cause weight gain. What do the studies tell us, and what should we be telling our patients?
This is probably the easiest question you've asked me. Hormone replacement therapy in every single study is associated with less weight gain than placebo. And I think one of the nicest studies that showed this was a study in which women were randomized to oral estrogen and progestin versus placebo for 3 years to see if estrogen would prevent heart disease in women with existing disease. And the women who got the oral estrogen and progestin gained less weight, had less increase in waist circumference, and overall had a less increase in their BMI because of the less weight gain. So estrogen protects against weight gain at menopause. And that's really one of the most positive things to come out of many of the studies done.
Yes, great information. So thanks for explaining the complex area of weight gain in menopause and perimenopause. Can you leave us with the most important points that you would like GPs to take home from our chat today?
As a GP, it's often considered confrontational to raise the issue of a patient's weight. But in fact, it's really important to talk to women about their concerns about their weight. And I often ask women if their weight is stable. And that opens the question. It is really important to not make them ashamed of their weight and also for them not to go off onto crazy diets, etc. And to offer advice where they can feel that they can come back to you and open the discussion again. I mean, this is a very sort of vague answer, but I just think having the conversation is okay.
I love that. Professor Susan Davis, thanks so much for joining us on Drive Time GP.
Thank you for having me.
This series, discussing the latest advice in menopause management, is brought to you with the support of Baisonz Healthcare, the makers of Slynda and Estragel Pro, Estragel and Prometrium for menopause hormone therapy. The substantiating references, links to relevant resources, and product information can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website, produced February 2025. Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. Beyond glycemic control, navigating PBS updates in diabetes care.
Welcome to today's podcast. I am Anita Sharma, a GP based in Brisbane. It has become clear in the last few years that SGLT2 inhibitors are not just diabetes drugs, but cardiovascular and renal disease modifying agents. A recent major change to the PBS funding now provides GPs an opportunity to expand the use of SGLT2 inhibitors for those high-risk type 2 diabetes patients who would benefit the most. On 1st December 2024, PBS restrictions for dapagliflozin were expanded to allow treatment in combination with metformin, unless contraindicated or intolerant, with no glycemic requirements for patients with type 2 diabetes and high cardiovascular risk, or those who identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders. Today, we are talking to Professor Jonathan Shaw, who is Deputy Director at the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute and Council Member of the Australian Diabetes Society. Professor Shaw will give us his insights on the implications of this expanded access to SGLT2 inhibitors for high-risk type 2 diabetes patients. Welcome, Professor Shaw.
Hi, Anita. Good to be with you.
So there's been a raft of changes to the PBS restrictions for type 2 diabetes medications in 2024. But hot off the press, the change made in December 2024 for dapagliflozin was a major step forward. Could you briefly run through what changed in this update?
Yes, so there have been a lot of changes over the last 12 months, and it can be difficult to remember exactly where we are with these. I think the best place to start is where we were prior to this change, where we broadly had three categories of subsidy for SGLT2 inhibitors. The earliest that we've been using, really since they became available, is as a glucose-lowering agent for people with type 2 diabetes. And to qualify for that, you had to have an HbA1c of more than 7%. Subsequent to that, we had added categories for people with heart failure and people with chronic kidney disease, and that was irrespective of diabetes status. And that's been helpful as well. That still left us with a substantial proportion of people with diabetes who were at high cardiovascular risk and yet didn't have the elevated glucose levels, the high HbA1c, that gave them access to these medications through the original indication, which was for glucose lowering. And it's that group that the most recent changes, beginning on the 1st of December 2024 has included. So what we now are able to do is for people with type 2 diabetes who are at elevated cardiovascular risk, and that's defined either by having had a previous cardiovascular event or by being at an increased estimated risk of cardiovascular disease over the next 5 years, or in fact, if they are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islanders, then irrespective of their HbA1c, an SGLT2 inhibitor can be used and will be subsidised by PBS. And this is a really important benefit and a really important advance in the way that we're able to treat people with type 2 diabetes.
So could you shed some light on how this change to the listing for dapagliflozin actually came about and your thoughts on that, and why was it necessary?
Well, there's been accumulating evidence now for a good number of years that among people with type 2 diabetes, these agents will reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, heart failure, chronic kidney disease in people who are at elevated cardiovascular risk. And critically, this benefit for cardiovascular and renal outcomes is not dependent on the glucose-lowering effect of these drugs and is not restricted to people who have high blood glucose levels. So really what this is doing is enabling the funding of a treatment for type 2 diabetes to catch up with the evidence and allows us, at least for dapagliflozin, to prescribe this for people who are at elevated cardiovascular risk, even if their glycemic control is quite adequate. And it also helps us, and I think this is a really important part of what this will do, it helps us to remember to separate cardiovascular risk protection from glycemic control. They're both critically important in people with type 2 diabetes, but we don't necessarily use all the same strategies to do one as we do the other. And doing one does not necessarily mean we are doing the other and achieving the other.
That's a great point. So improved access to SGLT2 inhibitors now therefore has the potential to change the treatment trajectory for our type 2 diabetes patients early in their disease journey. Now, before we tease the clinical implications out further, could you give our audience the key headlines on what this change will now mean for GPs?
Yes. So for the group of people with type 2 diabetes who have a prior cardiovascular event, we're talking about MI, stenting, angioplasty, stroke, symptomatic peripheral arterial disease, they can qualify through that. They can qualify through an increased risk based on the cardiovascular risk calculator. And for that purpose, for that indication, the person needs to have a risk of cardiovascular disease that is at least 10% over the next 5 years. And there was last year an update to the Australian cardiovascular risk calculator that can be used for that. That would be the second group of people. And the third group of people are those who identify as Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. And if a person has type 2 diabetes and falls into any one of those three categories, then they can be prescribed dapagliflozin on the PBS irrespective of their HbA1c. And in that setting, it is being used to reduce their cardiovascular risk. It will, of course, help to improve glycemia, but its primary effect there will be the very important thing of reducing cardiovascular risk.
So unpacking what you've just told us, we know that diabetes and cardiovascular disease often coexist, and it's a particularly dangerous combination. Hence, I think as GPs, we need to really be looking at these at-risk patients, which you've defined so clearly for us. They need to be identified early and managed proactively. And we need to think of using these medications earlier now. The dapagliflozin is available for us to use in that high-risk patient. So we need to really be thinking of now not being restricted anymore as we used to be by the A1C requirement. Now, Professor Shaw, how do GPs now keep this on top of mind to be using this treatment sort of algorithm?
So I think that this facilitates something that has actually been recommended in guidelines now for a number of years. And that is that when a person with type 2 diabetes walks into the clinic room, one of the first things you need to ask yourself is what is their cardiovascular and their renal risk? If their cardiovascular risk is elevated, either because they have had a cardiovascular event or because their estimated cardiovascular risk is elevated, then we need to be thinking of a range of interventions. We need to be thinking about statins. We need to be thinking about blood pressure lowering agents, particularly with ACE inhibitors or ARBs. We're used to doing that. We're used to thinking cardiovascular risk equals a statin. Cardiovascular risk equals RAS blockade with an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. And for some people, that cardiovascular risk equals aspirin or antiplatelet therapy. Now, we can add to that list that cardiovascular risk equals treatment with an SGLT2 inhibitor for people with type 2 diabetes. And now for dapagliflozin, that decision is subsidized by PBS.
That's such an excellent tip to think of it in those terms. Then we will definitely be using these drugs much more proactively.
And Anita, I think it's important that we separate that question about cardiovascular risk from the next question that we have to ask ourselves, which is, what about glycemic control? And these are two overlapping but slightly separate questions that we have to ask ourselves.
Yes. And essentially what you're saying is, you know, we've got to really move away from that age-old glycemic focus only for our type 2 diabetes patients. And like you said, every time a patient walks in, think about their cardiovascular risk and attend to it. Now, given that patients for whom we can now prescribe an SGLT2 inhibitor may already have an A1C below 7% because of this new listing, some listeners might be wondering if one can go too low by using SGLT2 inhibitors in this scenario. So are there any safety or tolerability concerns with this early combined therapy approach?
So, of course, it's always really important to think about the downsides. It's easy to talk about all the benefits, but it's really important to consider the downsides and the side effects. So, of course, all the usual side effects that we're used to with SGLT2 inhibitors are just as relevant in this population as they are in the people that we have been treating for a number of years. So that's fungal genital infections, it's risk of ketoacidosis, particularly in the setting of surgery or starvation and dehydration. But the particular issue that you raise here about the possibility of hypoglycemia also needs to be borne in mind. Now, for this purpose, we really need to divide treatments and drugs for diabetes into two groups. There are those that have a potential to cause hypoglycemia, and those that effectively don't. So the ones that can cause hypoglycemia are sulfonylureas and insulin. The rest of the interventions that we use, whether they be lifestyle or other medications, SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1s, DPP-4s, etc., thiazolidinediones, metformin, they don't really cause hypoglycemia. So if you add an SGLT2 inhibitor to medication that doesn't include a sulfonylurea or insulin, you don't need to worry about hypoglycemia. Now, you might decide that for pill burden, it seems reasonable to stop, let's say, a DPP-4 inhibitor and substitute an SGLT2 inhibitor. That might be a reasonable decision, though not one that's driven by safety concerns. But certainly, if the HbA1c is below 7% and the person is on a sulfonylurea or on insulin, I would be either stopping one of those or certainly reducing them.
So can we now try and put this opportunity that's now arisen with the new PBS listing that was going to change our practice into context?
I think that this new indication, this expansion of the subsidy really helps to push through the message that there are agents that we have, SGLT2 inhibitors and also GLP-1 agonists, which are beneficial for cardiovascular and renal risk. And it helps to emphasize what I was talking about before, about this separation in our minds between two overlapping but somewhat separate questions about dealing with treating the risk and dealing with lowering and controlling glucose. And whilst there is overlap of those two, they are not the same thing. And I think that this is actually going to get the message out that dealing with cardiovascular risk is really important and isn't just dealt with by lowering glucose.
Yeah. So really, I'm hearing that there's a great opportunity for GPs now to do a much more comprehensive risk mitigation strategy with our type 2 diabetes patients and make a difference. Now, as we are looking at prescribing two medications, say, for example, metformin and SGLT2 inhibitors for these high-risk patients without worrying about the A1C anymore. Does the new listing also include the use of fixed-dose combinations? Because as you can appreciate, these FDCs or fixed-dose combinations are popular for fostering greater patient adherence and reducing cost and pill burden for our patients.
Yes, I think this is an important point, actually, and one that we haven't quite touched on yet, which is that the particular listing that we have is, in fact, in combination with metformin. Now, of course, that doesn't apply if there's a contraindication or intolerance to metformin. But outside that, the PBS requirement is in combination with metformin. And obviously, that can be done as separate prescriptions, or it can be done as a fixed dose combination. And there are advantages of both fixed dose combinations. Some people like the idea of starting things off with a fixed dose combination. Sometimes it's easier to persuade patients of the need for two drugs if they're combined into one tablet. Other perspectives on this, I think, take a different view, which is that maybe it's better to start initially with separate ones. If you do have problems with tolerance, then it can be a little bit easier to stop one and continue the other whilst you work out which agent is causing the problem with tolerance. And practitioners, I think, are used to this sort of thing. Of course, we have fixed dose combinations in many different areas of medicine. It's not just in diabetes. And so I think, importantly, the opportunity is there and the flexibility is there for individual practitioners to tailor this to the patient that they are dealing with at that time.
Yeah, that's really good practical advice. Well, Professor Shaw, thank you for taking us so eloquently and comprehensively through the latest changes to the PBS listings for SGLT2 inhibitors for type 2 diabetes management. Could you please summarize the main points for GPs to take from our discussion today?
Yes, I mean, so the main point really is we now have this additional indication, this additional subsidy for SGLT2 inhibitors, and particularly for dapagliflozin, for people with type 2 diabetes who have an established history of a cardiovascular event or who are at least a 10% risk of cardiovascular disease over the next 5 years, as estimated by a cardiovascular risk estimator, or who are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, and that this particular reimbursement is not dependent on HbA1c and therefore can be used for people who have an HbA1c which is otherwise deemed to be within acceptable limits, more specifically is less than 7%.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Always good to talk to you, Anita.
Please note the PBS information for Forxiga, dapagliflozin. Forxiga is available on streamlined authority for type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and heart failure. Refer to the PBS schedule for full details. Before prescribing, please review the full product information. The substantiating references and product information can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in collaboration with AstraZeneca and produced in January 2025. Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. The Baker Type 2 Diabetes and Heart Failure Miniseries, Part 6, Spotting CKD Early, Optimizing Care to Slow Progression with SGLT2 Inhibitors.
Chronic kidney disease is a growing health problem in Australia, with more than 6 million Australian adults at risk of CKD, which is chronic kidney disease, and more than 2 million living with CKD. CKD is twice as common as type 2 diabetes, yet only 1 in 10 persons with CKD are aware that they actually have the disease, largely because it is an asymptomatic condition, with almost 90% of renal function being lost before becoming evident. I'm Anita Sharma, a GP based in Brisbane in Queensland. Today, we are joined by Professor Simon Roger, a consultant nephrologist and director at the renal unit in Gosford Hospital in New South Wales. Dr. Roger is with us today to take us through the recent developments and guideline recommendations for the use of SGLT2 inhibitors in the treatment of CKD, and to enlighten us about some of the screening tools for early detection of CKD. Welcome, Professor Roger.
Thank you, Anita.
So, up until recently, apart from RAS inhibitors, there had almost been a drought when it came to treatment options for CKD management. The arrival of SGLT2 class has definitely been a game changer, in that although first heralded as diabetes drugs, we are now seeing their impressive cardiorenal benefits. Can you take us through what the role of SGLT2 inhibitors is in treating CKD? And more importantly, how has the SGLT2 class come to be included in CKD management guidelines?
There have been multiple trials showing that the SGLT2 inhibitors were effective in delaying the progression of chronic kidney disease in people with and also without diabetes. And it's been years since we've had any new drugs come onto the market that we can use. We're now talking about four pillars of management. So the ACE inhibitors, the ARBs, then also the mineralocorticoid antagonists, such as finerenone that's come out, Kerendia is the trade name for that, and the SGLT2 inhibitors. So we've got a few things in our armory now to slow the progression of the CKD.
Mm-hmm.
So both international and local guidelines now recommend that those drugs are used. They say that you shouldn't start SGLT2 inhibitors if the eGFR is less than 20 mL per minute, 1.73 meters squared, but you still may get the non-renal benefits. And in the trials, they never stopped the drugs when the GFR dropped below that level.
So much like in heart failure, now we have four pillars in management of chronic kidney disease as well. And that's great because we have so many more treatment options for our patients. So it appears that SGLT2 inhibitors as a class have been recommended, as you said, by both international and local guidelines. Could you expand on which SGLT2 inhibitors are approved in Australia for use in CKD? And what are the prescription criteria that GPs need to be aware of? And perhaps what are some of the precautions and do's and don'ts that they should be also cognizant of?
Empagliflozin, Jardiance, or in combination with metformin, and dapagliflozin, Forxiga, again, can be combined with metformin, the two available.
So, empagliflozin is now approved for use in CKD patients.
Yeah, so really, it's the only one that demonstrates a reduction in the combined risk of kidney disease progression or cardiovascular death, and that's in a range of people with CKD. And we know the cardiovascular complications go hand in hand with kidney disease. The drug's efficacious, is tolerable, and it can reduce the progression of CKD and death from cardiovascular causes by 28% compared to placebo, which is a very impressive result considering the majority of patients were already on an ACE or ARB.
As you've just outlined very clearly, that empagliflozin has now been approved for use in CKD patients. Could you shed some light on the evidence that actually led to this guidance?
Well, the main trial was called EMPA-Kidney. It was a study of over 6,000 patients, and it included a broad range of people with CKD. And half of them had diabetes mellitus, and half of them had the lower eGFR. So it was very broad. It should be noted, though, that DAPA-CKD, which was the dapagliflozin trial, and EMPA-Kidney had different inclusion and exclusion criteria that I'd mentioned. So really, the trials can't be directly compared. Also, the prevalence of diabetes and glomerulonephritis in the EMPA-Kidney was 30% with diabetic kidney disease, 25% with glomerulonephritis. And diabetic nephropathy is really the epidemic. And those numbers reflect the causes of people ending up with end-stage kidney disease requiring dialysis or a transplant.
So from what you've just told us, the EMPA-Kidney trial included a fairly broad patient population.
It did.
Which is really reassuring for us GPs, given that such a broad inclusion criteria perhaps represents better the real-world patients that GPs see in their practices.
Very much so, very much so.
Yeah. So could you run us through the key findings of the EMPA-Kidney trial, just in summary?
Just a couple of comments. For the family doctors who read medical articles, they talk about the hazard ratio. And in the EMPA-Kidney trial, there was a 28% lower risk of progression of CKD or death from the cardiovascular causes. So that means that if you had X number of people in the treatment arm that got it over Y in the control arm, it comes out as 0.72. So that's a 28% reduction in the hazard ratio. And the trial slowed CKD progression across all GFRs and all albumin excretion rates, which it is very much applicable to the real-world situation.
irrespective of baseline. EGFR, irrespective of presence or absence of diabetes, it really gave the benefits.
Yeah.
So while the growing health burden of CKD in Australia is definitely a challenge for GPs, the availability of renal protective drugs like SGLT2 inhibitors also offers a great opportunity, I think, now. So I guess it's critical that we GPs have CKD on our radar when we see patients at risk of CKD, which are most of the patients we see with other comorbidities. So given the time pressures in primary care, do you have any tips regarding some easy-to-use tools for timely detection of CKD by a busy GP?
Kidney Health Australia is one of our support organisations, and they have a checklist. So when the patients are in assessing their blood pressure, if they have a blood test for a serum creatinine to calculate the EGFR and also to look at the albumin-creatinine ratio. If the results indicate chronic kidney disease, repeat the test, and they have a great algorithm in this Kidney Health Australia Chronic Kidney Disease Management in Primary Care Handbook. It's a free download. The only pest is it's 88 pages, so it's very extensive and thorough. But the algorithm is on page 16. And in my practice, for some things I have to refer to a lot, I just print it off and stick it in the top drawer so I can pull it out and see where things should be applied.
That's a great tip. I think Kidney Health Australia is a valuable resource for every GP. And just going zooming into that page, which has the three steps, the three-pronged approach in diagnosing CKD, is brilliant. Now, you did mention urinary ACR, which unfortunately, as shown in the REVEAL study conducted in primary care in Australia, is often not checked in a large proportion of patients. Can you explain to us what is the significance of measuring urinary albumin-creatinine ratio when it comes to CKD diagnosis and, say, prognostication?
When I have a patient who has glomerulonephritis, I use the analogy of the filters of the kidney, the glomeruli, being like a teeth strainer. And if the holes are too big or there's tears, then blood or protein or albumin get into the urine the same way that tea leaves get into the cup. I often get referrals where the family doctors have undertaken the albumin-creatinine ratio, but they haven't looked for associated hematuria, and that really changes the possibilities for it. So it is important to do it. Some people refer to the microalbuminuria as a marker of endothelial dysfunction within the glomeruli. And the higher the albumin loss in the urine, the worse prognosis for the kidneys. So that's why we try and reduce it with ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and SGLT2 inhibitors.
So it's a very significant indicator of kidney damage. And I guess it's very closely associated with outcomes. So we should be really vigilant about looking for it and looking at the trend, I guess. So it's very clear that we need to embed SGLT2 inhibitor use into routine care for people with CKD, and perhaps sooner than later. Could you perhaps give us some guidance on how GPs should incorporate the use of such efficacious drugs and integrate it into their treatment algorithms more efficiently and more often?
Yeah, rather than the diabetics, it's important to remember their use in patients with chronic kidney disease, with or without diabetes. And it's because of the treatment adds so many other cardiorenal benefits. But for any type 2 diabetics who are not receiving it, they should be because of the cardiorenal benefits as well as lowering the HbA1c. When I start people on SGLT2 inhibitors, you may need to stop them because of thrush or urinary tract infections. And I also tell the patients not to take it on sick days, where if they were sick enough not to go to work, not to have it that day or a few days later, it's because of the risk of ketoacidosis. I think it is important to knock off the diuretics for a couple of days beforehand and also one of the antihypertensives because of the risk with the naturesis losing sodium or the diuresis using fluid with it, that they can drop their blood pressure. And for the blood test results, just remember that, especially people with better renal function, that their EGFR will drop when they go into the SGLT2 inhibitors. It's reversible, it's expected, and just ignore it. Because what happens is that it then slows the rate of decline of the kidney function over time. So it's a much flatter curve than if they weren't on it, where it just heads downwards towards needing dialysis.
So that little drop in EGFR should not be a reason to stop them. In
fact, it's certainly not.
Just
it's expected.
And it does recover.
Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Now, the benefit of this class has clearly been established, and they offer us a great opportunity to change the trajectory of renal disease in our patients. Now, unfortunately, it still has been under-prescribed. You know, like you said, it should be considered in almost every patient with type 2 diabetes or has CKD. If I could ask you to give an opinion here, how many CKD patients in Australia do you think would be estimated to be eligible for an SGLT2 inhibitor just based on the clinical criteria?
That's a very hard question. Brendan Nguyen, who works at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, published earlier this year suggesting that there was a lot of undertreatment in the community. But the trial was done 3-4 years ago when the data was collected, and then 44% of patients with CKD were eligible, but only 4.1 were receiving treatment. I would really believe that that has increased a lot. With the referrals that I get from family doctors, more and more of them are prescribing the SGLT2 inhibitors.
So I think you've given us a very enlightening discussion on the role of SGLT2 inhibitors in CKD management. I have certainly learned a lot today about the prevalence, the morbidity and mortality of chronic kidney disease, and more importantly, the urgency for timely detection by primary care, who are often the first and sometimes the only point of contact for many patients. So I guess it's a call for action for us to really look for CKD and treat it more aggressively. For our GPs listening in today, could you please summarize the key take-home messages regarding early and optimal management of CKD?
Well, firstly, and the take-home message is that the progression of CKD can be substantially reduced if it's detected and treated early. The guidelines, both domestic and international, support that. The SGLT2 inhibitors have multiple metabolic and direct cardioprotective and nephroprotective effects. They are part of the four pillars of treatment. So the EMPA-KIDNEY with Jardiance did provide supporting evidence for the wider use of SGLT2 inhibitors, both with lower, higher GFRs, albuminuria, or no albuminuria, and the wide range of chronic kidney disease. So it is an opportunity to optimise care by detecting CKD and albuminuria early and slow the rate of progression so we're not having to put them onto artificial kidney treatment with dialysis.
Right. Thank you very much. That has been very useful.
Thanks very much.
Before prescribing the treatments discussed, please review the full product information. The substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by the Baker Heart and Diabetes Institute in collaboration with Boehringer Ingelheim and Eli Lilly and produced in December 2024. The statements, conclusions, and opinions contained in this interview are those of the participating spokesperson and not necessarily those of the supporting organisation nor Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited. Welcome to Drive Time GP, a podcast exclusively for healthcare professionals. An oral contraceptive option for women of all ages.
Historically, the most commonly prescribed contraceptive option in Australia has been the combined oral contraceptive pill. But now we have an oral progesterone option that has a similar efficacy and missed pill window to that of the combined oral contraceptive, which may be an attractive option for many women. Slynda, drospirenone, is a progesterone-only contraceptive pill, but not a mini-pill, that can offer the benefits of effective contraception with a more predictable bleeding pattern than other progesterone-only pills, and without the known risks associated with the combined pill. To discuss the use of Slynda in women of different age groups and with different risk profiles, we are joined today by Dr. Tamara Hunter, gynaecologist and fertility specialist from Perth. Welcome, Tamara.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, we just heard a little bit about Slynda, drospirenone. Can you tell us about it and exactly how it works as a contraceptive?
Yes, drospirenone is a really unique progestogen as it is derived from spironolactone. So it's got those anti-mineralocorticoid and anti-androgenic properties to it. It doesn't have any estrogenic or any anti-glucocorticoid activity. And so it has an activity that's very similar to the natural hormone progesterone. Now, the fascinating thing about drospirenone is that given it is in a dosing of 4 milligrams, they've determined that that dosing from a bioactive point of view, is enough to inhibit ovulation. So it is the only progesterone-only formula that's on the market that will suppress follicular stimulation and suppress LH surge, which is what is responsible for ovulation. Of course, it has the other progestogenic effects, such as thickening of the cervical mucus and also thinning of the endometrium, which is how other progesterone contraceptives work. It kind of encompasses both the estrogenic and progestogenic effects of the combined pill, except it's progesterone only.
Okay, so traditionally, progesterone-only contraceptive pills or mini pills have had some drawbacks. Can you tell us about the main differences between Slynda and the other progesterone-only pills available in Australia?
As you quite rightly pointed out, the progesterone-only pills have a very narrow range in which to take it on a day-by-day basis. And so if there is any irregularity to the time in which you're taking that pill, it will often lead to breakthrough bleeding. However, with the drosperinone, because it has a much longer half-life than the other progestogens, you can have a little bit more flexibility in the day-to-day habitual consumption of it and not then lead to increased breakthrough bleeding. So that's really good, particularly for young girls who might not be as compliant with taking the pill. There have been studies that also show that the bleeding profile is much more favourable, much more like the combined oral contraceptive pill, with much less breakthrough bleeding compared to the other progesterone-only preparations.
So Slynda is different from the mini pill, but can you also remind us how progesterone-only pills are fundamentally different from the combined pill in terms of risk profile due to that estrogen component of the combined pill?
Because of the estrogen component in it, there is an absolute increased risk of venous thromboembolism in all of the estrogen-containing pills as compared to those who don't take the pill at all. With a progesterone-only preparation, whether it's Slynda or whether it's one of the older style POPs, there is no appreciable increase in venous thromboembolism. In addition to that, there is also no increased risk in cardiovascular events such as stroke, whereas there is that with the estrogen-containing pills.
Great. And what about the overall safety profile of Slynda? What are the most common adverse events associated with using it?
As with many of the progesterone-only agents, we get quite concerned around the development of acne, strange bleeding habits, sometimes headaches, sometimes breast pain, sometimes mood disorder. These have been reported with Slynda, but to a much lesser extent. So the most common side effects in long-term clinical trials with Slynda include about a 3 to 4% acne rate, about a 2 to 3% irregular bleeding, headaches 2 to 3%, and breast pain around 2% as well. So it's a fairly favourable side effect profile.
So given the comparable efficacy to the combined oral contraceptive pill and the favourable side effect profile, Slynda could be a suitable initial oral contraceptive for women of all ages, our young ones, our older ones, and not just those at risk of estrogen-related side effects. Can we talk through the considerations for some of those different life stages? And let's start perhaps with adolescents who need contraception and have, let's say, period pain.
Because it has that longer half-life, 30-hour half-life, it doesn't need that strict intake as with the other progesterone-only preparations. And I feel that particularly with adolescent girls, it is an important advantage because of that compliance issue. And I think that that is something that may incentivize adolescents to take this as their first-line medication. I omitted to mention that one of the other risk factors to taking the combined oral contraceptive pill is migraine with aura. And I have a lot of young girls who come in with that. I think, therefore, Slynda is an excellent alternative for them to be taking first line. Now, as mentioned, it has that other beneficial progestogenic effect in that it thins the endometrium. And we know that by approximately 12 months of regular use of Slynda, about 50% of girls will be completely amenorrheic. So those with heavy and or painful periods, this is also an excellent option for them to consider.
So Tamara, we often in the GP world will see patients who come in, particularly our young patients, requesting an oral contraceptive pill to start with. And our default has long been to go for a combined oral contraceptive in that space and to offer that up first. What would your message be with regards Slynda in this space?
Well, I think it's important not to just put Slynda in the same category as the progesterone-only pills that are out there, because it actually suppresses the LH surge. So you're not getting ovulation. But not only that, you've got that better bleeding profile. So I think we should start to think of it in its own entity. I definitely think it should be a first-line option for young girls, particularly for those who are needing good contraception but also would like to be able to have control of their cycles as well.
So what about older patients in their 20s and 30s in that reproductive age? What are some of the factors that need to be considered when we're choosing a hormonal contraceptive in this group, and when might Slynda be a good option?
It has a very good recovery of fertility post coming off Slynda. Even though it does thin the endometrium, there's a very good recovery of a regular menstrual bleed once you see Slynda. So I think that's also quite favourable in those who might be considering fertility. And those risk factors associated with cardiovascular disease or other venous thromboembolic events is also quite favourable should there be any sort of complex medical issues in those women. There has been some concern as to whether or not it may suppress bone mineralisation and cause lower bone mineral density, but none of the evidence so far has suggested that it is suppressing of bone mineralisation at all.
And what about women who've recently given birth? What are the main considerations for use of hormonal contraception in the postpartum period?
I think that it's a very good choice. There's a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, pregnancy and the immediate postpartum is quite a pro-coagulant time. And so having a form of contraception that has the lowest risk of DVT-PE is good. The other thing too is women will often be breastfeeding and you cannot take a combined oral contraceptive pill or estrogen-containing preparation during this time. So again, having a progesterone-only preparation, I think, is a good choice for them. And again, talking to that flexibility of intake, if you're a sleep-deprived new mother and you happen to forget your pill, you've got a little bit more flexibility with its effectiveness given the long half-life.
And finally, what about our patients approaching the menopause? So a lot of them will get heavier, perhaps even more painful bleeding in the lead up to the menopause in that perimenopausal period. Could Slynda be considered here too?
Yeah, again, I think it's a good choice. There is the recommendation that we begin to think of different options for contraception for women sort of mid-40s to late 40s due to that DVT-PE risk and also impact on blood pressure and also deranged lipids. Because the progesterone-only preparation is not thought to impact these things, then I do think that it's quite a good safety profile to have as a contraceptive agent for women approaching the menopause.
Thanks for talking through those important patient profiles. And, you know, it's obvious we need to individualise every contraceptive consult, but Slynda doesn't need to be reserved just for our patients with contraindications to oestrogen. It can be an option for women throughout their life stages. Could you summarise the key messages that you want our GPs to take away from this discussion?
Yeah, sure. So Slynda is an oral contraceptive option. It has similar contraceptive efficiency and good use patients to the combined oral contraceptive pill and also that missed pill window flexibility. It's more predictable in its bleeding pattern, and it doesn't have those other estrogenic risk profiles of the combined hormonal pill. Slynda has been shown to be well tolerated and has a good safety profile. And as you mentioned, it can be used in young women, in women of reproductive age, and women right through to the menopause with good efficacy and good safety.
Tamara, that's been a wonderful session today and very informative. Thanks for coming along and sharing your knowledge with us today.
My pleasure.
Please note the following PBS information for Slynda. This product is not listed on the PBS. The product information and substantiating references can be obtained from the Drive Time Radio website. This interview was supported by Baisons Healthcare and produced in December 2024. The statements, conclusions, and opinions contained in this interview are those of the participating spokesperson and not necessarily those of the supporting organisation nor Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited. Thank you for listening. We look forward to your company on the next edition of Drive Time GP. Please note that the information provided in these interviews is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Always review product information before prescribing. The views expressed are those of the individual speakers and may not represent those of the supporting organisation or Drive Time Radio Australia Proprietary Limited.